Okay, my name is Rudy Edmond, and our session for this afternoon is going to deal with natural resources and mainly the management of natural resources as we see it as a part of our obligation. And I want to deal with two specific books. One is Earth Keeping, which is by Lauren Wilkinson, and this book here, you'll find it in the bookstore. And another one, which deals with the same kind of material, but in a different way, is one that I wrote, which is Sharing God's Gifts. So those two will really be the basis for what we want to consider during the hour. And I might tell you a little about how I come into this subject and what my background in it is, so that you know what kind of questions you might ask of me and what credibility I might have in relating some of these things to you. I am a geologist and have been since 1940, I guess. That's when I got my credentials. So that's been a long time that I've had an opportunity to study the Earth's resources and so on. And I've had the opportunity to teach in both Augustana College at Rock Island, Illinois, and at California Lutheran College in Thousand Oaks, California. In the interim, between those two, I spent 18 years in the oil business, and mainly was located in Oklahoma and commuted to all parts of the United States and particularly other foreign countries, because we dealt with trying to find oil and gas in all the way from Alaska down to Guatemala and into South America and over in the Persian Gulf and into parts of Africa. So that's my background. I've had 18 years in hunting for resources. And it was after I finished that stint that I came to Augustana College and I decided to develop a course. And the course that I developed and what we're going to really be dealing with, in essence, this afternoon is a course which I call World Resources. And it literally was exactly that. And we deal in the course with all types of resources, starting with energy, fuels, all of the fuels, the minerals, food, people as resources, land, particularly soil, and the development of that, and specifically also water and the air. So that's quite a bit to cover in one semester, and it'd be quite a bit to cover in 1 hour here. So obviously, we're not going to get too far through this. What I want to do is to give you some highlights of things that I think are important, things that have over the years been the subject matter of this course, which I still teach. And when I get back to California now, in another month or so, I'll be back in the classroom teaching this same course. So with that as an introduction, I'd just like to summarize a few things, and then I'd welcome your comments on how you see the resources of the Earth and our particular relationship to those resources. As I see it, God created the heavens and the Earth, and we believe that. And so the Creator is the one that we give credit for everything we have. These are gifts that we had nothing to do with. So when we came to inhabit the earth, all these things were there. And so we have to look at our own function then in terms of why are we here? And I think the answer to that, to me at least, is that we're, in a sense, managers of God's creation. We're placed here as something special in nature. We're not strictly in nature in the same sense that many animals, plants, and other forms of life are, but we were created in the image of God. And if we admit that we are created in the image of God, then we have to assume that we view these things, in a sense, with God. We're co-workers. And it is our obligation then to take care of and to manage particularly all of the resources that we have as gifts. So if we accept that as our responsibility, then we have a basis for considering what our real responsibility and obligation is in relationship to trying keeping these things in proper perspective and using them in a proper way so that really they glorify God in their final use, so that the earth is not desecrated and creation is not destroyed. But hopefully when our time is up on this earth, after inheriting these gifts, that when we are no longer occupying space here, then we leave the earth as in as proper a condition as we found it, and hopefully better, so that we hopefully can improve the earth during the time in which we have the responsibility of managing many of these things. So as we look at it, what I try to do in working with students is to try and have them understand something of the earth's system and something of the cycles of nature and the things that make up the way in which nature replenishes itself, and the things that where we're a part of nature and yet we're separate from nature in the sense that we are created with special gifts. Now, our special gifts are really the ability to manage, so that as we begin to look then at what we manage in order to provide for our lifestyle, then we try to look at the whole system as to where it is in the earth, where we can find it, how long it will last, how we might use it, and what the maximum benefits are that we can derive from these various materials. So if we just kind of take a look at some of the major things that we deal with in our lifestyle, certainly one of the things that is most important is energy. That is, everything in relationship to nature is related in some way to energy and the use of energy. And all of that system was going before we ever arrived on the scene. And the sun is the basic source of all energy. The earth has its orbit around the sun, and that's an energy system. And so as you look at the sun and the earth and the moon, these are things that are major proportions in nature and constitute the big things that we look at. Then as we begin to look at the earth and its in more of its subsystems, we find that such things as fossil fuels have been emplaced in the earth, oil and gas and coal. And these are legacies from the past, and many of these, you see, go back millions of years. And really all that coal and oil and gas, really what they are is pent-up sunshine. This was sunshine from many millions of years ago that through the process of chlorophyll and the various ways in which photosynthesis changes materials into organic material, the organic material gets buried, and that finally becomes the fossil fuels that we use now and are such an important part of our particular lifestyle. But what we need to take a look at is how important is it for us to actually have these things, and are these the kinds of things that we can expect will last for a long, long time? And, of course, you know the answer to that. The obvious thing is that there is a finite amount of these materials in the earth. And that amount is sometimes fairly well known, sometimes not so well known. And really, that's what the geologist is employed to do, is to try and find out where these things are, how much of them are present, and to make them available to our own lifestyle and our own consumption. Well, fossil fuels are very definitely limited in terms of their usefulness into the future. It's only been 100 to 150 years ago that we began to use these things to in any great extent. And we're drawing on a bank account that really is, if you think of it, like a savings account. Because these materials have been in the earth, and in addition to the normal system of energy which is present at the surface of the earth, we are the first animal, you see, or living form that has had the capacity to dig into the earth below the surface of the ground. Think of all the animals and plants that you know. They derive their energy, their food, and everything is right at the surface of the earth. But we have extended our dimension for living into the third dimension. So as you think of it, we live basically on everything that's on the surface, but that's not enough. We dig into the earth and we bring out oil, gas, coal, minerals, all kinds of things, and we mine them. And the term mine is an interesting term, because it really means that when you're mining something, you're really exhausting a resource that exists. And the finite amount of that will, at one time, at one day, be completely exhausted. So, if we think of that as a concept, that's an important way of looking at some of the other resources also. So, in a sense, we mine coal, we produce oil and gas, which in a sense is mining it, and we get it out, and then we use it up. And once we have used it, then it's gone. That is, as a bank account or as a source for this kind of energy. That doesn't mean that creation has stopped making coal and oil and gas. That process is still going on. But it takes thousands and thousands of years for the process to come to the point where you actually get a product. And so we know that this kind of material is still forming in places, but it's not going to be available to us unless you think in terms of thousands and thousands of years into the future. So that's not a very viable kind of option to build much of our lifestyle on. So we have a temporary kind of situation that we're dealing with now. And you realize that most of our energy today in the United States comes from oil and gas. About 75% of it, three-fourths of all the energy we use is derived from oil and gas. And the other, about 19% or so, comes from coal. And then the balance of it, you see a very small amount in terms of hydroelectric and in terms of solar, and geothermal, all of these other sources are very minor sources. The major source is oil and gas, and we're using it up at a tremendous rate. And it's hard to realize that today we will use up in the United States more than 16 million barrels of oil. And each barrel contains 42 gallons. So that just staggers the imagination when you stop to think about it. Tomorrow we use that much more. And so it's gone on, you see, for years, and is likely to continue into the future, you see, because now we're sort of obsessed with the idea that we have a glut of oil and gas. You know, we have too much. And so the price keeps vacillating a little up and down, and the newspapers are full of this sort of thing. But it's a very temporary kind of surplus that we're dealing with, and the time will not be long until we'll be back in the same kind of pinch that we have been in recent times, and the kind of thing that we should learn our lesson from. But it's very hard to be rational in these things. As long as the material is available and it's not too expensive, particularly if the price goes down a little, we use it up. And this seems to be one of our shortcomings that's very difficult. Well, fuel, then, is really a very major resource that we deal with. Would be metals. And it's hard for us to realize in the United States that we really are a have-not nation now in terms of the resources of a number of important industrial metals. You see, even iron, which was so abundant in the early days of the development of our industrial society here, the good iron ore is all gone. We have literally produced it and used it up. And now the only iron ore that we have left in North America is relatively lower grade, almost half of what the grade was to begin with. Up around the iron ranges in Michigan, Minnesota, and up into Canada, the iron was literally scooped up by bulldozers, and it was 60% to 70% iron. Now we have taconite in that same area, and the source of the taconite was the part that was left around the edges of these big deposits where there's still iron, but there's a lot of other material associated with it, and it's very hard to extract. So it calls for a benefaction kind of process that's expensive and uses up a lot of energy. And the only way we can keep steel rolling in the Great Lakes area is to now use taconite, which basically is about 35% to 40% iron at the most. So we've dropped from 60% to 70% iron down to a grade of ore that's much harder to process and much lower in its content of iron. And we don't normally hear much about this. The other thing that's even more critical is that all of the things that go with iron to make steel, we basically have only one kind of material in this country that we have in great abundance to make steel from iron, and that's molybdenum. And it happens that we have a little molybdenum prospect on the trail between here and Lyman Lake, you know, here at Holden Village. So that, when Bonanza and North Star Mountain got named for the first time, one of the reasons that the mountain up there was named Bonanza was because there was a molybdenum prospect there in the very early days when the maps were being made and prospecting was going on, even at the same time that the prospecting was going on for copper here. So that's the only real kind of material we have to put with iron to make good steel. Now, we happen to have the best supply of that of any country in the world. And so this is a trading material so that we can trade for chromium, various kinds of things that are needed to make steel from other parts of the world that we do not have. So we have to go scampering around the world in different areas to find the basic kinds of alloy metals that it takes to make good steel. And that's an important kind of thing. So iron and steel, which is really the basic kind of thing in our economy, is a very major thing of importance. And we are at a point now where it's cheaper. It's cheaper to import the ore and the metal from South America, Australia, other parts of the world, and then it is to process our own iron and steel. So it means that the cost of it obviously will go up and is continuing to go up as the material becomes scarcer. So the scarcity of that. Now, the other common metals, which are a part of our lifestyle, copper is one. And copper, at the present time, is in plentiful supply in this country and other parts of the world. But that's a matter of time, and the finiteness of the material, again, suggests to us that someday, maybe our own Holden mine here, what's left of the material that was not worked, may be of value, you see, in the future. So this is the kind of material that we think of in terms of the long range. Right now, it wouldn't be profitable to try and open the mine here and to extract the copper, but eventually, probably will be. So, who knows? 50 years, 100 years from now, you see, we have to think of this in terms of managing what we have here. So we have a problem that exists within our own village here in relationship to that kind of resource material. Now, that's just to cite a couple of the kinds of things in terms of metals. Metals are important, obviously, and they're a very important part in our industrial complex, so we consider that they're essential, and we have to get them from someplace. And our trade, foreign-wise, you see, becomes very important. Well, fuels, metals, let's look at water. I would say that water in the future is probably going to be one of the most critical kinds of material that we have at the surface of the earth to manage and to take care of. It isn't that we're short of water. But the point is that the water that we use constitutes fresh water, you see, not salt water. So if you think of the fresh water, all the water on the earth, 99% of it is not usable. Less than 1% of all the water on the earth is readily available for our society and for our use as a humankind. So, it's a very critical issue. Where I come from, in California, it's a major topic, you see, and we have to plan to get water to areas where the people are, and that's becoming an increasing burden as time goes on. And the unfortunate thing is that people like to live, particularly in certain areas where there isn't any water. And so they think, well, we'll tap the water from San Francisco and bring it to Los Angeles. And that failed to pass the voters in the last go-around. And there's a limit to the amount of water that actually can be brought into any particular area. Now, there is not a limit to water. And one way we have of getting fresh water is to take the salt out of it. Now, that's fine until you think of the cost. And the cost is mainly an energy cost. And with the cost of energy high, it costs a lot of money to produce fresh water from salt water. So that's not a very viable option. I have a friend who is an engineer who's working on a project in Los Angeles right now to simply put a lasso on a big iceberg from down in Antarctica and bring it up to Los Angeles. And it's almost feasible to do at the present cost of fresh water. And perhaps in the future we'll be thinking about schemes of this kind, you see, to bring icebergs from way up either north or south and simply float them in, put a jacket around them, let them melt, and then use the water. It's fresh water. You see, when you freeze the water at the poles, you freeze all of the salt out. So it's good fresh ice, salt. It's salt-free ice, so it makes good fresh water. Well, it's these kinds of things, you see, that we're beginning to think about as we look at the availability of certain resources into the future. And water is one of the most critical. Because we have gone the easy route so far, in a sense we have mined the water that's underground. See, we've drilled wells wherever artesian water could be found. This was particularly true of the Great Plains area, you see, and that's what made it possible to develop South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, and the Great Plains states, because there was a ready supply of groundwater that had accumulated over the eons of time. And it was, again, a bank account that could be drawn on. And so we have literally tapped those sources and brought the water out. Yes, we made good use of it, but there is the time, as you look ahead, you know, it's not going to be there. And even now, the wells that used to flow now have to be pumped. And eventually, you get ahead of the whole supply, and then the source, in a sense, dries up. That is, you can't get enough out to supply the kinds of things you need for agriculture and so on. Now, in California, the main use of water, as is true in the whole United States, is for agriculture. And we use great quantities of water for agriculture. So that's important. But the question is where it's finally going to come from in the long run. And we have to manage that kind of distribution. so much for water. Let's take another one. And I think the most critical one of all is soil. I think it's hard for us to realize what's really happening in terms of soil in our own country. If you come from the Midwest, you know, this is really the garden spot in many ways of the world. There isn't any place on the surface of the earth, because that had mainly two things going for it that I'd just like to cite to you. One is the fact that it's an area which was covered by the glaciers. And all the good soil is basically where the ice came across and brought the material down from Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Canada, and left it down in Iowa and Illinois and Ohio and so on. And in a nice spread of thick deposits of loose material, capable of absorbing a tremendous amount of water. And on the surface then, the thing that makes it usable is the fact that the climate is just exactly right. Now, why is the climate so good? And we think of North America from a resource position. Now, if I can picture this in words well enough so that you can get the picture, because I don't have a map, it's easy to show this on a map. But look, think of North America. Think of the Gulf of Mexico, and think of the currents of air that are moving from the Gulf of Mexico north because of the natural circulation of the air between the North Pole and the equator. And that causes a flow that comes right up the Mississippi River Valley. And it's confined on both sides, just like a funnel. The Appalachian Mountains on one side and the Rocky Mountains on the other. And so that warm, moist air from the equator, the air is saturated with water. It moves it north, and you all know how sticky hot it gets in this part of the country in the summer. And that's just wonderful, you know, for crops. It's not so good to live there in August or July or whatever, but boy, you can just see that corn grow, you know, and it grows because there's a built-in system, again, which we had nothing to do with, and you couldn't design it better. There is no continent on the earth that has a design like North America for allowing for this funneling of this flow of moist air, which when it gets north, then it cools, and then it precipitation, you see, and so we get, the crops are watered beautifully. You couldn't build a better system. But why doesn't Russia have this? They have as much land as we have, but look at what's on the south side of Russia. They've got that mountain chain that goes all the way across. And they don't get the water. They don't get the moisture. The climate is different because, simply because of the physical arrangement of the land area. And we, I think, have a hard time realizing what a gift we have in North America, just as a continent in the layout of it. You see, and to say nothing of the West Coast area where we've got California, one of the great agricultural states and coming right up the coast, but particularly in the Middle West. We raise so much food, you know, that we export. We export 40 to 50% of everything we raise. We can't eat it, can't use it. You know, it's just more than we can deal with. And so, while the rest of the world, much of it, goes hungry, we have an absolute excess of food, and it's because we have soil. Now, let's look at that. Soil is the basis, the basic reason why we have it. That is the thin layer that exists between the rocks of the earth and life. You see, everything derives its source of energy from the soil. All animals have to eat plants, and all plants have to have their roots in soil. And so soil is absolutely critical to life, you see, on Earth. And so we must not let our soils get away from it. Now, you may not realize or have heard that to produce right now a bushel of corn in the Midwest takes a toll of 2 bushels of soil. So for every bushel of corn we're producing today, we're losing 2 bushels of soil. Where does it go? It goes down the Mississippi River, it's in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's buried, of course, in the Gulf, and that's where it'll stay. So that soil is gone. We have now reduced, if you just take it across the whole Midwest, where all of this great agricultural area is, we've reduced the amount of soil by almost half what it was originally. So when you think of where it was to begin with, roughly 12, 14 inches, it's now down to where the soil base is about that thick. And each year, we're losing a very substantial amount of what's left. So erosion, and this kind of thing, you see, because of overproducing, you know, we're not satisfied with a good crop. We want a bumper crop, you know, and the corn crop has to be super. We if it doesn't produce in the, you know, way up over 100 bushels to the acre, why, we think we have a crop failure. Or I remember as a boy, I lived on the farm in southeast Iowa, and if we got 50 to 60 bushels of an acre, this was a good crop. And my dad was satisfied with that crop. And every third year or so, he didn't plant a corn crop on that same piece of land. He put it into clover or oats then. And so we had a crop rotation. Now, we can't afford to do that. Agribusiness does not do that. Agribusiness can't afford, because the profit that they must generate, cost of machinery, the cost of everything else. So what do? We take fertilizer, which is artificially made from where? Mainly from oil and gas, you see. So we're using our petroleum to put back on the land in the way of nitrogen and various kinds of materials, and feeding the soil and producing bumper crops, you see. And at the same time, we're losing a good part of the soil from the point of view of erosion. And what we try to look at then in terms of the future is, well, how long can you go on doing this? Obviously, it can go on for some time yet. And within your lifetime, There'll be a deterioration, but it's not going to be catastrophic. But what'll happen the next 100 years, you see, if we continue this same process, it can't go on forever. Because we're allowing the soil to get away faster than it's being regenerated by natural sources. Now, at some point, you know, you're going to have to deal with this. And that's one of the things that I think we really don't appreciate. Now, it calls to mind something that I think I'll just read to you. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this book, The Earth is Sore. The Earth is Sore. Written by, it's a collection of Indian writings relating to nature. One of the articles, which is by Chief Seattle, is a very important article, and it appeared way back in the 1800s when the federal government was trying to buy up the Indian lands. And so the Indians were being propositioned to sell their land for certain amounts of money. So let's just listen to what Chief Seattle had to say about that. How can you sell the sky, the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. We do not own the freshness of the air or the sparkle of the water. How can you buy them from us? We are part of the earth and it is part of us. The flowers are our sisters, the deer, the horse, the great eagle, these are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadows, the body heat of the pony and man, all belong to the same family. The shining water that moves in streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you the land, you must remember that it is sacred. And you must teach your children that it is sacred. In a few more hours, a few more winters, none of the children of the great tribes will be left. The whites, too, shall pass. Perhaps sooner than other tribes. Continue to contaminate your bed and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. Now to think this was written back in, 1870, 1880, pretty much gets at what the real problem is. The earth is sore wherever we have touched it. And we have mutilated it according to the Indian way of their feeling for the earth. It's a very sacred kind of thing. And I think you might enjoy just looking at some of the writings that are in here that relate to nature. Now, one of the things that I try to deal with in this little book is, it's a study book developed for the American Lutheran Church. And it was a part of their stewardship program. And I have been on my soapbox on natural resources and soil and this kind of thing for some time, and they knew of that. So they asked me if I would just put down some of these things in a booklet form, which could be used in congregations as study groups, adult study groups primarily. And that's what it's designed to do. But one of the things that I call attention to here is the relationship that exists in regard to nature. How do we view nature? We're created special. We're to have dominion over the earth. Now, that concept in terms of the way the church has dealt with this has been very detrimental to our environment. And the case can be made that really this is one of the most damaging things that has happened. Now, I like Joe Sittler's idea in his little book, Nature and Grace. And you might look at that sometime. And it deals with the same topic of nature relative to God. And Joe Sittler points out very succinctly in his own inimitable way that in the Hebrew, to begin with, there was no separate word for nature and God. Whenever you would be referring to nature, that was God, or God and nature are really the same word. And there is no separation between nature and God. But to the idea of subduing nature and having dominion over nature, you see, has taken root. And it's taken root to the point that it's all right to do this. And it has been condoned, you see, to the point where it really should not be condoned. And I'll not read this, but any of you that are interested in that particular aspect, think about it, because the same topic is taken up in earth keeping here, in our Christian obligation. And again, he makes an even stronger case here that a great deal of damage has been done just because of the way we think of ourselves as having dominion over. The proper way to think of that word and that concept from a Hebrew point is really that we're caretakers. We are people who are put here as gardeners in that sense. We're servants, you see. And when we look at the role of Jesus, you see, who is brought by God to redeem the fallen earth and that, you see, that is the concept that Jesus did not assume the arrogant position of being strictly a God, but a servant, the servant role. So we have to assume the position that we are the servants, we're the co-workers, we're the managers, and we then are to manage nature. We're a part of nature, and we're not separate from it to the point that we dominate it. And this is one, I think, of our greatest problems that we deal with today, is how do we proceed into the future working with nature rather than trying to conquer nature. Now, when you go back to the early days, you know, the early days of, the 1800s, the 1700s, so on, things were pretty rough from the point of view of natural things that happened to people. And nature was an enemy in many ways. And we still think, you see, in terms of getting ahead of nature. Well, we have in many ways, many beneficial ways, but we have allowed that to dominate our minds to the point where we damage nature as well. And unless we can find a workable relationship between our existence and the natural processes that go on in the world, you see, it's a question of whether we really have a sustainable kind of society. Now, I brought down another little book here that you might like to be aware of. This one is The Sustainable Society, you know. And there are other books, Enough is Enough. And you can just cite a whole list of them. I give my students that I have each semester a list of about 100 books now that are on the market that really deal with all of these topics. And they can choose from them, you know, and then we share with one another what we learn from these various kinds of things. There's another little book here called Food, Fuel, and the Future, you know. And so there are so many things that are being oriented now to the future. And to me, this is the hope. It's a matter of education, and we must come to learn what our proper relationship is to nature and our God, and how then we can deal with that in terms of managing what we have. and dealing with it in such a way that we maximize the use of it, and so that it eventually does become the glory of God, you see, that is a part of the creation as it was intended. Now, I've rambled on too long. Let me just open this up and let you ask questions. What would you like to ask about?
Who wrote the Sustainable Society?
Who wrote the Sustainable Society? Robert L. Stivers. Robert L. Stivers. And you're all familiar with Elements of Hope, which has some beautiful things in it also. And I would recommend that to you. Also, Resources of the 21st Century. You know, this is an official publication of the government. And this is a summary issue from several volumes. And it simply points out the highlights of what we have available for the next generation after this one. And this is put out by the United States Geological Survey, you see, and it's a geological survey circular, which is free, almost free, from the U.S. government printing office. So, you know, and it deals with everything that we've talked about here so far, and what the prospects are for the materials to be available in the future. That's, I'll just give you the, it's a circular of the United States Geological Survey. Then, of course, you know that up here as a resource book here in the village, we deal with the Global 2000 Report, which deals with the best study that we can come up with in terms of the science people to tell the President of the United States what might be expected for the year 2000. You know, this is a presidential study, and it's a very sobering kind of book to read as you look at the year 2000 from the point of view of natural resources. What other question?
It seems to me that you explained kind of what the problem is, and then the next step is what you're
going to
do about it.
What are we going to do about it? All right. That's obviously the bottom line. That's the key question. Now, instead of going through and telling you all of the things we might do about it, the last chapter of this book deals a possible future. And it's a series of guidelines that we might use. And let me just thumb to them here. And if you're interested, you know, in getting this book, you'd, I think, find it very, very worthwhile. There are some 30 suggestions here. What do we do about the future? And let's just look back, see what number one is. I don't know that that's the most important one. To exercise the power inherent in our dominion must be rooted in knowledge, wisdom, and wonder. So if we're going to dominate in these areas, we should have knowledge and wisdom and a sense of wonder. The demands placed on stewards by both the human population and the ecosphere are complementary. So the ecosphere and the humans who are a part of it, these are complementary kinds of things, and we can't deal with one without the other. So, and it gives a number of things related to that. We have the responsibility to work toward a just distribution of all energy and mineral resources, which really means sharing. And that's the thing I've tried to hit on in this book. That is the only way we can rectify these things is to share. Now that hurts because we're the ones who have the most. And if there's going to be sharing in the world, it's got to be by the developed countries, and the United States is at the top of the list. We have more than anybody else. So if we're going to help the situation, somehow we have to share. And one of the things that I try to deal with in here is that these things we have been given in common. The air is something we share in common. We have no right to pollute it for somebody else. The water should not be polluted. That's something we have in common. The soil and the land. You know, that's why the Indian says, you can't sell it. It doesn't belong to us. It's God's land. And the only way that you can view it as is that you are given a temporary time in which you can use it. I raise the question in here, see how you would answer. Is there any place in the Bible or any place else which really would suggest that you have the right to own land? Is there any way you can justify the right to own land? Well, think about it, you know. And I think we can't turn things around, you know. I recognize that. We're not going to give up all the land. The farmer is not going to share his farm with everybody else unless he's forced to. But if you look at this in terms of the right to ownership of natural resources, then you have to acknowledge that if you're going to buy it and own it and use it, it ought to benefit all of society more so than if it were owned by all of society. If you can take it and own it and improve it and make it better for all of humankind, then yes, maybe you can make a case for owning it. If you own it to make a profit, to advance your own interests, maybe you can't make a case for that. You know. How would you respond? You agree?
Yeah.
What are we going to do about it, though? You know, how are we ever going to get to the point where we're going to share?